supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. It was well below freezing outside, but that didn't stop the mummers from strutting down Broad Street today. The annual New Year's Day parade in Philadelphia went off despite concerns from city officials and mummers themselves that it might be too cold. WHYY's Joe Hernandez was there.
Mummers start early. I run into John McDevitt a little before 10 a.m. outside a Center City pizzeria. I ask him what he's drinking.
Miller Lite.
And whiskey.
Yes.
And the police are riding by, I should just say.
It's New Year's. Doesn't count.
McDevitt is with two friends. All three are dressed in gold bodysuits with green frills. Their faces are painted half green, half white, and they're holding small umbrellas. They're members of the O'Malley Wench Brigade.
No, we're Outback. It's like a Australian theme.
Okay. What are you going to be doing?
Strutting. That's it. You're looking at it. We're drinking and strutting.
Ladies and gentlemen, Quaker City Street Band!
The parade almost didn't happen. City officials and some mummers' divisions were concerned that the cold might pose a health risk, but also that it could be difficult for the musical brigades to play their horns and banjos. But mummery prevailed, and the comics, wenches, fancies, and string bands strutted down Broad Street after all. That was welcome news to Jim and Debbie Hennessian, who drove up from Westminster, Maryland to see the mummers for the first time.
So as we're driving up here, the temperature's hovering around 6 or 8 degrees in the car, right? I'm watching the needle. And then finally when it hits 11, I say, look, a double digit. She looked at it, and then it dropped back down to 8.
The Hennessians had never heard of the mummers before yesterday. They were looking for something to do and found the parade online. Right after a passing mummer tosses a handful of fun-sized candy bars into Jim's lap, I ask the couple what they think of the mummers so far.
It's a blast. I mean, they're drinking beers and...
I mean, what is that? They drink alcohol and smoking, whatever they're smoking, walking down the street. Yep. Who are the mummers? Anybody can be a mummer or what?
Two more converts to a Philadelphia tradition. Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Meanwhile, the bitter cold is expected to continue through the week, and for homeless outreach workers in Kensington, the epicenter of Philadelphia's opioid crisis, that means trying to persuade often reluctant drug users to come inside. Details from WHYY's Aaron Moselle.
A couple days before New Year's, Robert Pfeiffer is leaning against the wall of the homeless shelter where he's been staying since last week. It's 24 degrees out and dropping.
You don't fall asleep in weather like this. It'll kill you. You know what I mean? You won't wake up. It's as simple as that.
Pfeiffer is 62 and has been addicted to heroin for more than a half century. The last 3 years, he's been living on the streets. He says the frigid forecast motivated him to come inside, but he also says homeless outreach workers caught him at the right time.
If I'm doing little, I'm more susceptible to help, you know? If I'm doing a lot, you don't hear nobody.
Outreach worker Nick Hale has been told no a lot in Kensington during this Code Blue alert. When Philadelphia declares a Code Blue, shelter beds are added to the system to provide more room so homeless people can come in from the cold. Even when someone on drugs is lucid, Hale says they're often hesitant to head to a shelter if it means going to another part of the city and possibly going through withdrawal before they can buy more drugs.
They might not be so keen to go because they'll wake up sick in the morning, and what are they going to do in West Philly if they don't have a token or a way to get back?
Luke Dunn scours the neighborhood with Hale. He doesn't get upset when drug users don't want help. He knows what it's like to have an addiction and how hard it can be to let go of it, even for a night. Dunn says part of his job is simply to let people know he's around to help. During a recent ride through the neighborhood, Dunn rolls down his car window at a red light on Lehigh Avenue after spotting a familiar face panhandling in the street.
Dude, I had this coat back there. You don't have a coat?
Don't have one.
I'm going to circle back and see if I can get this coat for you, all right?
Awesome.
You know, dude, whenever you're ready, bro, you know, man. All right?
Even today.
Under a bridge on Frankfurt Avenue, Dunn introduces himself to a man he's never met before. The guy's staying put, but he gives Dunn his info, name, date of birth, last four digits of his social security number, so it can be typed into a city database that keeps tabs on homeless people outreach workers come in contact with. Certain treatment and housing programs need to know exactly how long someone has been living on the streets before accepting them. They rely on the database for documentation. Dunn and Hale say helping people get out of the cold feels good, but helping them move towards a better life, hopefully an addiction-free life, that's what keeps them going when they feel like heading inside to warm up. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania is poised to join 23 other states and Puerto Rico in naming a state amphibian. The Eastern Hellbender has become a major contender for the title, thanks to support from environmentalists who say the creature can bring awareness to water quality issues in the state. To fill us in on this big salamander with an ominous name, WHYY's Kimberly Haas spoke with Steve Flath of the Academy of Natural Science of Drexel University.
So, Steve Flath, can you describe this largest of aquatic U.S. salamanders, the Eastern Hellbender?
Yeah, Eastern Hellbenders, they're a fully aquatic salamander that will vary in size between about 15 inches to about 2 feet. They're a mottled brown color, ranging into coppers, depending on locality and whatnot. They have very, very tiny, beady eyes, and they're very slimy. They're also called snot otters, lasagna lizards, a whole bunch of other fun nicknames for them. But they live mostly underneath large rocks in fast, cool streams that need very, very pure water quality that have high dissolved oxygen.
So that's probably why most people in Pennsylvania haven't seen one, because they're nocturnal hunters and then they're under rocks during the day.
Absolutely, yeah. They in the past, they used to be all over Pennsylvania, except for mostly the Delaware watershed. But due to many, many different reasons, also because they're rare, they've been dwindling in number rapidly.
Choosing a state amphibian may be just sort of a little joke, a little curiosity. It may seem like it, but the Eastern Hellbender, the choice of that, I think, was a deliberate choice because it's an indicator species, because, like you said, it needs very clean, fast-moving water. And the fact that it's declining in Pennsylvania says something, right?
Absolutely. It's a perfect opportunity to bring awareness of this animal. They're what is called a habitat specialist. So because they require such pure water and they have such a strict diet, they're a really good indicator species on whether or not your habitat is doing well. And so having this animal as a flagship state amphibian can show how we're doing as far as making our habitats and local environments cleaner and better.
How much has its range in the state declined?
Based on Western PA, it's kind of really, really hard to put a number on exactly. They used to be found in over 50% of counties in Western PA, but they've definitely shrunk. They've halved that since then.
So there's been success in breeding them in captivity and then introducing them?
There has been very, very, very small success. Since they're such a habitat specialist, their care is very difficult. And then also getting them to go into a breeding cycle and things like that, it's a little bit of a tricky situation to recreate. There's plenty of zoos and other types of institutions that are trying to captively breed them. But at the moment, the only places that have been successful within the U.S. is the Nashville Zoo and then also the St. Louis Zoo.
Besides the projects to try to breed them in captivity and then introduce them to the environment, in Pennsylvania, are there projects to just consciously improve the environment for them?
We can do a lot to try to improve the environment. Unfortunately, it's kind of a difficult process because there's so many reasons. One of them is siltation. If you go out into the streams, you'll notice a lot of the streams today are becoming dustier. They'll have a silt buildup on the bottom of them, and that silt will kind of fill up the dens and create no sustainable habitat for the hellbenders to create their dens and reproduce and whatnot. So you'll have siltation, you'll have pollution, rising temperatures in water, things like that.
Has Pennsylvania's mining history been an issue here too?
It definitely could be a factor with all the mining that goes on. There's a lot of runoff. Also, just the rural buildup as well will help allow silt to run into your waterways and fill them up. But Pennsylvania's mining history can definitely add to the amount of silt going into the water.
Steve Flath, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Steve Flath is reptile keeper at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University.
Johnstown, Pennsylvania, is most famous for the catastrophic flood that nearly wiped out the city in 1889. Now, it's dealing with a different kind of flood, one involving sewage and lots of it. Keystone Crossroads contributor Margaret J. Krause reports that as cities across Pennsylvania struggle to fix their water and sewer infrastructure, Johnstown provides a cautionary tale.
Johnstown sits in a low-lying bowl of land at the confluence of two rivers, which link to form the Conemaugh. It's a river Johnstown would love to turn into a recreational asset, but there's a big problem. When it rains, stormwater overwhelms the sewer system and sends urine and excrement pouring into the river. To fix that, city leaders have undertaken a massive overhaul of the sanitary system. Raymond Balta is board chairman of the local redevelopment authority. He says there's no glory in rebuilding a sewer system. It's a painful necessity.
You're not going to sit on the front porch and say, hey, Mike, come over here and look at my lateral lines, huh? I mean, aren't they beautiful?
Johnstown has avoided the sewer problem for decades. It took state intervention to make something happen. In 2010, Johnstown signed an agreement with the Department of Environmental Protection, or DEP, to rehabilitate its sewers by 2023, or risk penalties for violating the Clean Water Act. It kicked off what's essentially a citywide makeover. 98 miles of sewer lines that serve thousands of homes and businesses. And that created a new problem. People are peeved.
I just think the planning just is lousy. They keep changing horses in the middle of the stream.
That's Bernie Kircha, a lifelong resident of Johnstown. His exasperation at the sewer project, now moving into its seventh year, is understandable. Imagine your city's being torn to pieces, and you have to suddenly invest some $4,000 to replace the line that runs from your house to the sewage mains. Kircha knew it wasn't going to be fun, but he was pretty resigned to it.
DEP said that they had to stop this sewage going into the river because of the people downstream. They use that water. Okay, I understand that. I wouldn't want to use somebody else's toilet water.
Kircha's 86 and has seen how resilient Johnstown can be. He lived through two of the big floods, one in 1936 and one in 1977, and watched the city rebuild. He replaced his sewer lines a year ago, but has watched his neighbors struggle to afford to do the same. He's not alone in his frustration. It seethes at monthly city council meetings.
Yes, I'm done.
Let me address hers, if you would, first.
I just started talking to her. Can I finish saying what I was saying?
Sure, but I was going to address what she was asking, but go ahead.
At a recent meeting, there was confusion around who knew what about a sinkhole likely created by the SOAR project, a rundown of city finances that lasted 2 hours, and frequent spats between the mayor and members of council. It was 10:30 at night before public comment began.
I got here at 6 o'clock from work, I stayed till 9 o'clock, and I saw dysfunction.
Resident John DiBartola used his 5 minutes to express disappointment.
No talking about job creation, no talking about saving our town. I'm embarrassed. I went to dinner because I had to have a break from you people.
Johnstown Mayor Frank Janakovic says he gets that the process has been difficult, but...
The can's been kicked down the road for too long, and... If some of these things were done, if we could always change the past, that would be great, but we can't. And I can assure you, we're trying to do our best to please all entities and do the job right.
Johnstown is not an outlier when it comes to these problems, though its situation may be more severe. State officials say the sewer systems of 143 municipalities across Pennsylvania have in some way violated state and federal law. In Johnstown, residents understand why the state has ordered the fix, but it's expensive. Deindustrialization shrunk Johnstown's tax base. The city's run a deficit for 25 years. And then the sewer project came along with its $165 million price tag. At City Hall, there's a sign hanging on the building's front door. It reads alive and well and open for business in downtown Johnstown. But former city manager Arch Liston says the SOAR project is one of the things that makes attracting new companies a lot harder.
They're going to look at us and they're going to say, well, your costs are too high. Your debt is too high. Your pension liability is too high.
The state revolving loan fund, PennVest, has covered some of Johnstown's costs, but there's a limit to how much they can help. They're supporting 140 other wastewater projects across the Commonwealth. So for Johnstown, one of the only options to pay for the SOAR overhaul is to raise water and SOAR rates. Liston says more and more people are walking away from their homes because they can't handle the costs associated with upkeep. He's worried the increases in water or SOAR bills could be the last straw.
It's creating a substantial financial burden that in 10 years could create a financial collapse of the city.
To avoid that, city leaders are hoping to find some way to restructure the project's debt. Regardless, in 2018, the next sections of the city are slated for SOAR reconstruction. Margaret J. Krause, Keystone Crossroads.
On this first night of the new year, let's look back on Heavens Above highlights from 2017 and then make our New Year's revolutions with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, happy New Year to you.
Thank you, and happy perihelion to you.
And so before we turn the page, let's look back on some highlights from the previous year.
I think probably the one that people are most aware of was the Great American Solar Eclipse, which in August became the first eclipse, solar eclipse, total eclipse, to cross the entire United States in about 100 years. And it is said that 80% of the American population saw that eclipse in one way or another, which is miraculous for a science event for people to have participated in. And now everyone can't wait until the next one here in the United States happens, and that's in 2024. People were also very excited to learn about the Laser Interferometry Gravitational Wave Observatory. Say that five times really fast.
If they could pronounce it.
If they could. Let's just call it LIGO, okay? So LIGO actually is a new observatory that detects gravitational waves that are created by very, very massive objects colliding with each other. Very, very big collisions at great distances out across the universe. The most intriguing thing about this is not that these waves actually occur, although they were predicted by Einstein very long ago, but that Einstein himself said that we probably wouldn't be able to measure the gravitational disturbance in the space-time continuum because it would be such a low signal level. Our hats are off to the engineers who designed this equipment that has the sensitivity to be able to detect gravitational waves from these very, very distant events that opens a new chapter in how we observe the universe and what we add to the story of the universe that we already have.
Amazing. What if Einstein had that avail back when he was coming up with his theories?
I think that would have really gone a long way to help people feel far more certain about Einstein's genius. It was a thought experiment for him to come up with the idea that this kind of energy was out there in the space-time continuum, which certainly was a crazy way for people to think of the universe's structure when he first suggested it. But this would have certainly pointed to that and indicated that indeed he was correct about how the universe really is structured.
So we're detecting faint gravitational forms of energy from collisions that took place very, very far away. And by that, we mean very, very long ago.
Exactly. So the real implication here is that these events occurred, like you said, a very long time ago, very, very far away. So there's no other way for us to detect that this event actually occurred. We wouldn't know that these events occurred if it weren't for the gravitational waves that are being detected by this very, very new and sensitive instrument. There would be a whole chapter of the universe's existence that we wouldn't know about. We could certainly speculate, but we have no data about it. Now we do have data to indeed tell us that what we suspect may have been going on way out there in the dark actually did happen.
Oh my God, we've had the Great American Eclipse and we've found gravity waves. Sounds like 2018 is going to be a big letdown.
Well, not quite, because we'll have more of these detections of events that happened early in the history of the universe. But we also can look forward to continued preparation of the James Webb Space Telescope that will now be launched in early 2019, because it too is going to add to the early history of the universe, our understanding of the early history and evolution of the universe, using this revolutionary piece of equipment that's going to be set a million miles away from Earth, much more sensitive than Hubble Space Telescope is, although in a different wavelength. yet at the same time not serviceable. So it has to work when we actually set it out to be used, but it will open doors and windows to our understanding, very much like the gravity wave detectors have done, in ways that we haven't been able to do so before. We can also look forward to continued opening of the door to space through the commercial space entities like SpaceX and Blue Origin. So that will continue to push all of us toward more human exploration of space. And the Trump administration is backing this up by telling NASA that they now have a green light to go ahead with reaching out for the moon again as a way station toward our human exploration of the deeper reaches of our solar system, including that wonderful red planet Mars.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Bitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.